It pleases the court, William Fritchie on behalf of Mr. Munoz, and it is indeed a privilege to appear before you this afternoon. This is a case about a man that, without so much as a high school diploma, is serving a consecutive life sentence for possession of amount of cocaine that, as I understand it, would now be a misdemeanor. In October of 2003, a division of this court remanded this matter back to the district court for findings of fact on the issue of justifiable excuse and excusable neglect. It took 6 years, just short of 6 years, to get that before the court into a hearing, which occurred February 13, 2009. Mr. Munoz was represented by counsel who argued persistently that Mr. Munoz would benefit from the holding in People versus Klaus. It was on all fours, according to his counsel, taking the position that he got an additional 3 years to file a second post-conviction 35C against post-conviction counsel. Because of this, Mr. Munoz objected. The matter went to briefing. I was appointed during that period of time, and it was at issue January 11, 2010. It then took the district court 18 months to issue a ruling, and only after I threatened to invoke CRS 13-5-136, we finally got a decision. And now the argument before this court is whether it was Mr. Munoz who caused the delay. By my calculation, attorneys and courts took 12 and a half years. Mr. Munoz took 2.5 years. We were not able
we're not talking about that entire delay. The only delay that's at issue here is from the time that his first 35C was decided until the time he filed, right?
Agreed. Okay. Although the district attorney in the Denver District Court kept arguing that it went back to the date of his conviction in May of 1988, which of course is not the law. We had tons of relevant facts. I've got over here a stack of certified records from the Court of Appeals that we think was relevant. We have letters from attorneys relative to delay, and we would like to have the testimony of Mr. Munoz as to issues at Lyman Correctional Facility. The inability to get to the library, the inadequacy of the library, medical issues that interfered, writs, he was being written out to testify in his juvenile son's matter. Lots of facts that were not on the record that we should have been able to present.
Were they in the motion to the court?
They were pled, and I think that's what the issue really is about today, Judge. They were pled, but we did not present the evidence. It would have been many, many, many pages. And I think the obligation under White, under Wiedemer, and one other case that I forgot to bring with me, he only needs to plead sufficiently to raise the issue that, if true, would have brought him relief. And what happened was that we didn't plead all the evidence that we had. We only pled the issues.
Well, counsel, his obligation is not just to plead excusable neglect or justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. He has to plead facts which, if proved, however proved, would show justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And don't we have to look at the motion he filed? We just look at the motion he filed to see whether he pled those facts.
In 2003, the division of this court entered a ruling that he had sufficiently pled justifiable excuse and excusable neglect.
I don't read that at all in the order. What it said was the court didn't consider that sufficiently. What the court had done before is it had not considered the fact that he couldn't have brought his original motion in a certain time, and said that for that period of time there is excusable neglect. Okay, for that period of time. But there's this 2.5 years later after that that the division didn't opine on at all. And it seems to me that's the question. Did he plead facts to show justifiable excuse for that 2.5 years thereafter where he didn't file anything?
And I would submit that if you go back and look at that order, what the Court of Appeals said was, well, we don't find that he pled sufficient Gene issues as to this, as to that, but we do find that he pled sufficient Gene issues as to post-conviction counsel, and that's why they remanded it back.
No, no, they remanded it for findings as to whether he had done that. They didn't say he had done that, or it simply would have said, all right, you get a hearing. The court did not do that.
I would respectfully disagree if I could find it.
I've got it right here, and I'm reading it, so I'm just telling you what it says.
All right, what I'm going to try to do is that the issue, the decision that came out from the Denver District Court, four pages, a little over one of them actually addressing issues. Most of it was addressed to the history of the case. And I think the district court minimized the issue of access to the law library. The federal courts are all over this issue on the issue of access to courts. They have held in Williams versus Leak, which is a Fourth Circuit case, the 45 minutes three times a week in the law library is insufficient. Mr. Munoz got 1 hour a week, not 45 three times a week, and we would submit that that was insufficient. We should have been able to raise those issues as a matter of evidence.
Well, Mr. Munoz was able to file a federal habeas corpus during that time period in spite of minimal access to the law library, correct?
Mr. Pincus of the Federal Public Defender's Office somehow got involved with that, and there was
got involved, but he was appointed, and the petitioner filed it first. Isn't that correct?
I believe so, but I was not involved that. Don't have all the facts, that, Your Honor, but I believe that the only relevance I felt this had to that is that the file was taken from the Denver District Court for a period of time. It didn't last long in federal court, but that was another period of time when the Denver District Court did not have jurisdiction.
No, how does it not have jurisdiction? I'm confused about that.
The federal file.
Are you saying you can't file a simultaneous state and federal proceeding?
I'm sure that's true, but you certainly wouldn't be able to proceed on it. And I think the court's point is well taken.
Why would he not be able to proceed on it?
Because there was no file. The file had been transferred to the federal court.
It could not be transferred back?
I guess so, Your Honor. I didn't really get too deeply involved into that part of it, other than I felt that that was another evidentiary matter that was of some relevance.
Mr. Fritchie, is it Fritchie?
Fritchie, thank you.
Thank you. But the issue you're presenting to us, I want to be clear, is that there should have been a hearing.
Yes.
And that's the issue that you want us to answer, the question. Did this court err when it did not give a hearing?
I believe that is precisely okay. The issue, Your Honor. And they're blaming him for all of these delays in period of time, and yet the courts took years and years and years. 18 months to even render a decision after it was briefed. The Bounds versus Smith case, which is a United States Supreme Court case, says that inmates need to have adequate libraries, or they need to have someone help them. And Mr. Munoz was by himself during this period of time. And then the court made a big deal out of the fact that it was an 80-plus page petition. And boy, I mean, Mr. Munoz is verbose. And that was one of the issues I had with him. He would write me letters, and I said, you know, four pages, could you put a paragraph in here someplace? And it just goes on and on and on and on. But that's because he doesn't have the education that we have, and certainly he didn't have Westlaw Next.
But don't we have case law on point that says the lack of understanding of the legal system and that, all those sorts of things, isn't justifiable excuse or inexcusable neglect?
There is some to that effect, but there's also a federal case, and admittedly in a bankruptcy setting, where excusable neglect is a somewhat elastic concept and is not limited strictly to omissions caused by circumstances beyond the control of the movement.
But you can see the problem. All these 35 C's come from prisoners in prison with limited access to law libraries, with little understanding perhaps of the legal system. If we say that's enough to establish justifiable excuse or excusable neglect, the time limits mean nothing.
True, but I don't know whether this. I have been to Lyman Correctional Facility. I can't tell you how many times that place goes on lockdown. I mean, it seems like every other time I go there, I can't go in because it's in lockdown, or I get stuck in there because it's in lockdown. That facility is in lockdown a lot. These are things that we believe we should have been able to present as evidence. Agency of the defendant, there's a United States Supreme Court case, Long versus District Court, that says that these are meant to be for the affluent as well as the indigent. In that case, there was a $4 filing fee that the petitioner objected to. That goes to the fact that it took forever for Mr. Munoz to get any copies because he didn't have the money to pay them to make copies. Mr. Munoz suffered illnesses. United States versus Andrews, which is a 10th Circuit case, 790 Federal 2nd 803, 1986, talks about that illness is a factor in a gene equation. And I've got all these records from Lyman Correctional Facility as to the times he was in the infirmary. We were not able to present those because we didn't have a hearing. So we would have had medical records. We'd have hoped to have records of lockdowns. There were significant absences due to writs. And there's one other issue that I'd like to quickly raise, and that is in Close versus People, 180 Pacific 3rd, 1015, the 2008 decision, it talks about the issue of public defender conflict becomes a viable argument as to justifiable excuse. And that's what we have here. The issue really is his post-conviction counsel was a public defender. The trial lawyer was a public defender out of the same office. And she said, on the record, I'm not going to raise issues against my former public defender. So that's where this falls apart. That's where, because she wouldn't raise those arguments, Mr. Munoz, and then he gets into the situation where, gee, you want a lawyer? Do you want a lawyer? Don't want a lawyer? And so he ended up asking for Ms. Cruz on appeal. But our facts are very similar to Close in that there was a public defender conflict that should have been considered in terms of the justifiable excuse, and I believe that was raised, and I'd like to reserve my time.
You may. Thank you.
Hey, please, the court. Jonathan Farrow, Assistant Solicitor General, registration number 35754, on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. To be sure, this case has a long and at times confusing procedural history, but the issue before this court is straightforward, and it can be reduced to three questions. First, what was the scope of the remand? As Judge Jones pointed out, and I quote from the Court of Appeals opinion, the remand was for findings of fact and conclusions of law made after an evidentiary hearing, if necessary, regarding the existence of justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. Now, in the reply brief, there seems to be an argument that the sufficiency of Mr. Munoz's allegations can no longer be questioned. But again, this court made no such holding. It did not find justifiable excuse or an excusable neglect as a per se matter. It did not remand for the consideration of the merits of Mr. Munoz's claims. It merely held that the fact that his first 35C motion, his first proceeding, concluded after the three-year statute of limitations period had run, that fact alone, just on the face of it, could possibly support an allegation of justifiable excuse and excusable neglect. The district court's error was that it failed to even consider that. It failed to even examine justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. That's why the case was remanded, and that is exactly what the sole issue was on remand, the sufficiency of the justifiable excuse or excusable neglect, if any, here.
Well, Mr. Farrow, in examining that question, what can we look at? Because we have the original motion, and then the appeal, and then after it's remanded, he files the supplement, this massive 47-page thing that he calls an amendment or a supplement. Mm-hmm. That somewhat troubles me. Seems to me, don't we have to look at just the original motion?
It troubled me as well, Your Honor, and reading the cases from this court strictly as I think that the court should. Yes, absolutely. At this point in time, though, he was allowed, that motion was received,
right,
and the court did rely on it in its ruling. I did not assert that in the brief, and I really see no reason to assert it today, because that motion itself, taking everything in there as true, is insufficient to establish justifiable excuse or inexcusable neglect, and I will address some points from that directly.
Well, how is it insufficient to justify a hearing on that issue?
Right, because again, he can get a hearing if he says something in there that, if true, could, as a matter of law, establish justifiable excuse or inexcusable neglect. And then the hearing is just a matter of credibility, a chance for him to actually prove the veracity of his allegation. But if he doesn't make the allegation, if the allegation itself is bare, conclusory, or just insufficient on its face, that even if you assume it's true, then there is no need for a hearing, and really a hearing is absolutely inappropriate.
Well, Mr. Farrell, let's say, for example, his allegation that he had some medical difficulties and spent quite a bit of time in the infirmary. If that had eaten up most of the 2.5 years, then wouldn't that be sufficient, and shouldn't he have a hearing, say, on that sort of issue?
It could be, but here's the problem in this particular case, is that Mr. Munoz never made an allegation that particularized. He never said that that they ate up the entire 931 days. So again, the second question, which we kind of skipped over, which is fine, but that, what is the scope of time that he had to justify? I think it could be longer, and I've argued that in the brief, but you know, for purposes of today, at a minimum, and I think they concede, we're looking at that 931-day period from when the mandate issued in the first post-conviction appeal January of 97, to when he filed his second motion in 1999. All right, so then, the allegations that he has to make, he has to excuse and justify that entire expanse of time. And what he did in this case, as far as the medical allegations, he actually made them quite specifically. He listed a lot of specific medical ailments. The only one of which occurred before he filed his motion was a diagnosis of hepatitis B. And there's a discussion of a surgery related to that, but that surgery, according to Mr. Munoz's allegation, took place after August 1999. He talks about a diagnosis for rheumatoid arthritis. That took place after August of 1999. So those allegations, they have absolutely no bearing on justifying the 931 delay period that he needs to justify. And while I'm on that, I'll hit a couple of the other allegations and why they're sufficient. And that's really the third question here. And one of the primary one is that he had a general misunderstanding of the law. And as you said, Judge Jones, plenty of cases from this court that state that that is just, you know, facially not adequate as a matter of law to establish justifiable excuse or inexcusable neglect. The only apparent specificity that he brings on this allegation is that he thought perhaps he was entitled to a new 3-year statute of limitations after the first 35C had concluded. And reading the allegation as it's stated in that handwritten motion, I would consider it to be more of an argument to that effect, rather than I believe that I thought I got 3 extra years. But at any rate, we can assume, just for the sake of argument, that he did take that next step. That is still a misunderstanding of the law. It's only now on appeal, in the briefing, that there is even a hint or a suggestion that this misunderstanding of the law is actually a misadvisement claim or allegation, which is entirely different. And to quote from the opening brief, and this illustrates why it's not a sufficient allegation on its face. However, if appointed counsel failed to correctly advise Munoz of the law, the evidence in support of that allegation extends far beyond a mere statement that he was ignorant of the law. Well, yes, it would if, in the reply, the evidence is expected to show that Mr. Munoz's misconception came from his inexperienced public defender. If that proves to be the case, the next sentence continues. Ifs and nays are never sufficient to establish justifiable excuse or excusable neglect on its face and justify error. Mr. Munoz carried the burden in this case below, and he has never alleged an actual misadvisement by any of his lawyers. That's a fatal lack of an allegation. he does spend quite a bit of time talking about what his attorney in the year in 2009 may have suggested to him and argued very strongly that People v. Klaus had a three-year automatic renewal or a tolling or something, which we know is not accurate. Even if that's true, what he may have been told in 2009 by a different attorney is entirely irrelevant to what he had may have been misadvised, possibly, that's all we have here, back in that relevant time period of 1997 to 1999. A few other matters. Of the 386 days that defense counsel claims Mr. Munez was away from prison, Mr. Munez's own justifiable excuse and excusable neglect motion states that between the dates we care about here, November 10th, 1995, going back even further, all the way up to November 15th of 2000, he was only, by his own allegation, away from prison for just 27 days. Now, what if? What if even we misread that and he had alleged he was away for 386 days? Well, that still leaves 545 days in the 981-day period that he would need to justify. So the absence alone could never get him there. We talked about the medical issues. He talks about some transcripts and records that he needed to obtain. It's a little unclear whether he had to absolutely attain them for the second post-conviction as opposed to why he didn't need them for the earlier ones, because the only dates and specificity that he gives in his motion indicates that all that stuff he had received by 1997. So again, that could not have been a reason for his delay. He also says that he spent time seeking federal habeas corpus relief. Well, first of all, we know that he filed that motion about 1 year into this time period, in December of 1997. So even if that is a valid excuse, which it isn't, it would only cover less than half of the relevant time period. And then secondly, choosing to seek a remedy in federal court was his own decision, his own choice that he made freely. Just because he chooses to do that, and even if he devoted 100% of his attention to that, how could that possibly be on its face a justifiable excuse or excusable neglect to seek a second 35C proceeding in state court? It can't be. He talked about the court file not being in Denver District Court today. Well, I can at least possibly conceive of maybe there would be a difficulty between the state court and the federal court transferring records back and forth. I practice habeas law, and sometimes that happens. But how does the lack of the court file in Denver, even if it could somehow slow down the proceeding of the 35C, how does it stop him from making a timely filing of the initial motion? It can't. So that doesn't apply either. He says that he spent a lot of time seeking relief from the robbery conviction in the other case. And again, that's the 35C that he filed before the one that issued here. But the court can look at the substance of that motion and compare it to the motion that issued here. There's a lot of the same law, a lot of the same type of claims, ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. I believe they were different lawyers, but again, all the law as a boilerplate is the same. So if the issue is that he had trouble with the law library and whatnot, why was it that this was that filing it in the other case somehow hindered him here in this case instead of helping him and actually making it more efficient? By his own allegation, he spent a year on that motion, but the one in this case apparently took much longer without really any explanation. And then finally, I would just say that any notion that he's not a competent pro se advocate must be refuted by the record. He's managed to prepare numerous legal motions in this case. A federal corpus proceeding, as Judge Boras pointed out. Multiple 35C proceedings. And the motion at issue in this case exceeds 80 pages and has 35 separate claims. Now, he's certainly entitled to present as many claims as he wants and spend as much time on them as he wants to, but he gets 3 years to do it. And the law doesn't give him more time just because he wants to recharacterize or recast claims in a different way and raise 30 of them or 35 instead of just 5.
Does he get, you said he gets 3 years to do it, but he had 3 years and he filed his timely first, yes, 35C. Okay. And it seems that what the prior division did was say, okay, this second one may or may not have been timely, but it didn't really look at a three-year period. It was, I mean, what period are we looking at? I know there was this gap of 931 days, but how do we decide how many days is reasonable?
Right, and it is really is case by case, because all I meant when I said 3 years was just the statutory initial period. When you get into the realm of justifiable excuse and excusable neglect, as I'm sure the court is aware, you look at the cases, and there is a wide range of time periods that the court has allowed and to find that they were excused. So, I mean, it really is case by case, but all that the court needs to consider in this case is that the district court was asking whether a 931-day period was excused or justified, and that's what's before the court today. And again, Mr. Muniz just hasn't made the allegations that he would need to make to justify that entire period of time. I mean, could a longer period be justified in certain cases? Absolutely. But in this case, 930 days was not. And
quick question about the standard review. Is it a question of fact, the court's finding of justifiable excuse, excusable neglect, or is that a de novo question of law?
I believe here it is de novo because the district court said that it was assuming everything he alleged was true. And upon that assumption, the court then concluded as a matter of law that all of those allegations taken as true did not arise to the level of justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. In closing, even defense counsel characterizes the 931 days, that delay period here, as the only period of inactivity in this case. Well, that's the only period that matters today, and Mr. Muniz was ultimately inactive in that period. It simply cannot be said that he has not had a meaningful opportunity to challenge his convictions. For those reasons, I would ask that the ruling below be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Mr. Fritchie.
Thank you, Your Honor. Reading from the earlier decision, which was October 9, 2003, our review of the record revealed that defendant failed to affirmatively plead the existence of justifiable excuse or excusable neglect in relation to his claims of ineffective trial and direct appeal counsel. Therefore, we conclude based on the face of the motion, files, and records that those claims were untimely. Then he goes on, however, we conclude that the trial court erred in summarily dismissing the remaining claims related to the effectiveness of post-conviction counsel without findings of fact and conclusions of law. The trial court's order finding the lack of factual affirmance to support the existence of justifiable excuse or excusable neglect is unsupported by the record. And I would submit that that's the law of the case, that he did plead effectively the gene issue.
Would you have gotten a hearing? So, I mean, in a sense, what you're saying is that under the Court of Appeals decision, they were in effect saying the mere pleading that this was an appellate counsel and that the decision on the appeal didn't come until 1997, that would entitle by itself, that would entitle you to relief. And you would get a hearing, I guess, on that. Why would you even need a hearing? I'm sorry, I got multiple questions.
Yeah.
So let me go back to ground on this. As I understand your argument, you're saying that the Court of Appeals decided that he had already pled enough to earn a hearing.
That's how I read the opinion, but they put this little remanded for a hearing if necessary in that decision, and that's all the district court. That was the entire focus.
What had he pled at that point in time that would have benefited from a hearing?
The medical issues, all of these things that were arguing, the medical issues, the writs, all
of those. But he hadn't pled any of that. All he had pled was, it's my appellate counsel.
Your Honor, I have to plead a little ignorance here. I didn't get into that issue because I believe the Court of Appeals said he had sufficiently pled it. And that's, I took that as a given, perhaps foolishly. As to the public defender, Ms. Cruz being inexperienced, I have a transcript in my file where she goes in with a public defender supervisor in another case, very shortly after Mr. Muniz, telling the court, Ms. Cruz is not properly trained to do a 35C, and she needs to be released. We had that, we were unable to present it.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. Having heard oral argument and received the briefs, the case now stands submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.